Welcome back to Techadopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Josh Frulinger. He's a writer at ThinkNum. This is Techadopia. This episode of Technotopia is sponsored by CheapTranscription.io. CheapTranscription offers 10 cents per minute transcription using our happy robots, or 85 cents per minute using our human assistants. CheapTranscription.io is cheaper and faster than everyone else. CheapTranscription.io. This episode of Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus is a full-service editorial agency that brings amazing editors from places like the New York Times and TechCrunch to work on your writing. Need a blog post, a white paper, a presentation? The Typewriter team can write or edit anything on nearly any topic. Visit them at typewriter.plus for a free quote. That's typewriter.plus, typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Joshua Frulinger. He's editor-in-chief of ThinkNum Media and a longtime journalist. Welcome, Josh. This has been a long time coming.
Yeah, we've never done this before. Feel like, we should do this more often. Let's do it tomorrow.
Every day? We can do this every day. Actually, I think in lieu of therapy, I think we should just do this.
This feels better than therapy.
So we were literally just talking about journalism, blogging, all the things that that essentially destroyed us as young men. What's your take on things now? What are you doing over at ThinkNum?
Well, strangely enough, circuitously enough, I'm kind of back to where I started. I'm blogging again. I spend my day doing anywhere from 2 to 10, 3 to 500 word stories for this startup called ThinkNum. I launched a media arm called ThinkNum Media, who is in what's called the alternative data space. And we do stories based on data that we find, alternative data. So that means everything from it's external data. So it's all the stuff that we pull off the web, off of public APIs and that kind of stuff. So we're looking at everything from how many people Apple is hiring over time. We're looking at pricing trends at Amazon, sales rank trends at GameStop and all that kind of stuff. Location data, where stores are opening and closing locations, where, crazy chains like Oyo are opening new, hotels in China and India and that kind of stuff. And what happens is, as we grab these snapshots of this data on a daily basis, they create time series and we see movement. So we see trends up and down in hiring or locations and that kind of stuff. And we can measure the proximity. And as someone who has been chasing information and chasing the truth for half of his life as a journalist and writer, I get to sit on top of this massive database and report on actual stuff that people can go and verify. And when I stumble upon stuff, which has happened a few times, I feel like it happens every day now, I have that old exhilarating feeling again. So, I know I'm drinking the Kool-Aid because I'm at a startup, but it sort of feels like that again.
Mm-hmm. So you're actually doing a journalistic arm of a for-profit enterprise. I mean, it's basically you guys are doing analytics. What's going to happen in the future in terms of journalism? Is Sony going to do its own blog where it talks about only Sony products? Is that the situation? Are we going back to like the days of soap operas brought to you by Dove soap, that kind of thing?
Well, I'm pretty sure Sony's already doing that. I know all these companies do that. They've all got blogs and they hire out agencies and they do marketing content and content strategy and content marketing. Our business model is, I wouldn't even call it unique, because honestly, Bloomberg did the exact same thing that we're doing. They just did it 40 years ago when they had those initial data terminals, and Bloomberg was sitting on top of all this financial data. And he's like, holy crap, this is potentially really interesting to the business crowd. And the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times don't have access to this data. So we're going to launch a media arm that's going to get people excited about the data. And hopefully they'll sign up for these Bloomberg terminals, which was their sort of main money maker. And we're structured in the same kind of way. So if you see something, one of our stories, and it looks really interesting, you're like, holy crap, I want access to that data. You can, sign up for a demo, just like you would a Bloomberg terminal. And, if you sign up, my company makes money. So my role here is to, my role personally is to, write amazing stories, I think. But if it excites someone and they have the budget to do so, they can sign up for a demo and maybe become a client of the company. So, It's similar to what they were doing there. The thing that I love about it, though, is I don't have to deal with advertisers. And it's the first time in my life that I don't have clients or advertisers who are coming to me on a daily basis and sort of saying, you know, it'd be really nice if you said something good about, mm-hmm. you know, X, Y, and Z.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating point. I mean, you're like to be able to not worry about advertisers, and that's actually where I kind of am at CoinDesk right now. There's not a lot of advertisers on the site, and that's because it got kind of dicey during the ICO days. How do we make money as journalists if we don't have advertisers outside of being like, I don't know, a house organ for something else?
Yeah, and that's something that we've all been struggling to figure out. You know, the original model obviously was subscriptions. You know, you have the town crier at the corner saying extra, extra. You sell a paper for $1. You bring, you know, the $20 back. You get a cut of it. And, you know, that's how you sort of make money off of subscriptions. And then they started advertising to all the local people who want to get their stuff in front of it. And that's sort of where we're stuck between those two models now. You know, people all day long are still talking about those two models, which is either or both advertising or subscriptions. People are doing, you know, there's a lot of models in between where they put some stuff behind, you know, paywalls. I know Business Insider started doing that recently. Some of your colleagues started publications that are 100% behind paywalls. Seems to be working for them. I don't know what the numbers are, but honestly don't know, you know, how sustainable either one is. You know, a lot of people have experimented with hyper-local advertising, like, you know, Tim Armstrong and AOL infamously tried to do with Patch, and it feels like that's an experiment that people try and fail at multiple times. You know, and I'm in this weird space now where I'm experimenting with a model that I think has been, you know, it's obviously been tried before, as I mentioned with Bloomberg, but it's interesting for us because while I start the day off thinking I can write about anything, there is still that sort of bird in the back of my mind, or the bee buzzing around my bonnet, that sort of says, well, I should write about something that at least is going to create some interest in the product. So, you know, and I fully admit that. As far as the future goes, I'm not sure. You know, I think we're going to have a period where people begin experimenting again with different forms of blogging and microblogging. I think there's a lot to be learned from what's going on in social media, you know, on Instagram and the whole influencer market, which I feel like people have stopped talking about strangely, but it's still a very healthy market, you know, where people just get paid to be who they are, which I think is kind of a future that I think people don't talk about because it makes them uncomfortable.
I mean, ultimately, are they being paid to be who they are? Are they being paid to be a persona of, I don't know, happy-go-lucky fan of anime, or, I don't know, cat person, or sexy lady in bikini kind of situation? I mean, everybody's adopting a persona. I mean, you could also argue that any journalist is adopting a persona as well. Are the economics there different than anything that's happening in the Hollywood studio system, except that the Hollywood studio system had 70 years to build itself out, right?
Your example of Hollywood is spot on. And that was the first thing that I was thinking of, because that's kind of the world that I come from. I grew up in Southern California, and I was surrounded by Hollywood, and I still have friends who are in the industry, some of them, you know, relatively well known. And I've been around them, you know, amongst their families and their people when they're sort of what they say, and it's really strange, sometimes disturbing, where they'll be like, I'm off brand right now. Like, no social media, don't take pictures of me, don't post this and that kind of thing. And then they'll let you know at certain points, like they're gonna take a picture or a selfie at dinner or something like that, and they'll be like, this is for the brand. And this is something that they're thinking about all day long as they go through life. So I think you're absolutely right. This is something that they figured out a long time ago in Hollywood. I think the difference that we're seeing now with influencers and social media personalities and the happy-go-lucky anime fan who goes to Comic-Con and takes all the selfies and generates business for other people is that I think maybe it's an illusion, but I believe it. I think a lot of them are real. You know, and I think that's at least the dream. Obviously, they're not all real. I mean, I'm sure we've found that a lot of these influencers is a bunch of crap. But I think that there are some where that's actually them, and that's what they do. And the interesting thing about that is that that's caused problems for some of them, because what ends up happening is they realize that their entire life is on display. And when you get paid to be yourself and you stop being yourself, because people change over time. And we've seen this time and time again. We're seeing a lot more of it lately, where people would be like, you know what, I'm out. I don't care how much money this is making me. This is messing up my life because I'm being paid to be who I was when you all liked me 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. What's the that's the question. How do we create an entirely new media that uses all of these tools? When we were coming up, we were bloggers. We destroyed modern media as we know it by being faster and worse than almost every other magazine out there. And that's exactly what people wanted. They didn't really care. It's like the uncanny valley. The fancier it gets, the more people believe you, and the unfancy it gets, the more people believe you. But if you land in the middle there somewhere, it's weird.
It's a cyclical thing. You're absolutely right. It reminds me of what happened with punk rock in the 90s when, punk rock started as this reaction to everything and people are like, yeah, this is awesome because, the Ramones are doing stuff on stage and in music and in the studio that no one else has ever done before and they're breaking the mold. And then 20 years later, you had, Green Day and all these other acts who sort of, commercialized it. And the second that you commercialize rebellion, it breaks the mold. It breaks the illusion. And I think the same thing has happened with, with journalism. As you mentioned, 18 years ago when we all started blogging, we were the rebels. We were doing stuff. We were breaking the rules. We weren't allowed at CES. We snuck into CES because we weren't considered real journalists. And then what happened is we were doing it more authentically. We were breaking the rules. We were allowing ourselves to say bad things about Microsoft and Apple, whereas no one else was, because those were their advertisers, and people turned to us. And ironically, all those same publications that you and I used to work for are now the mainstream media within. Yeah, everything flipped. If you're asking about like what the next inflection point is, I mean, you'll have these, micro revolutions again. People will find different places in media or different, micro blogging places, and they'll do exactly what you and I are doing now, which is we'll step aside, hand the keys to other people, and try different models and see if it works. Like you mentioned, you're going through, experimenting with stuff you're doing. I'm doing the same with what I'm doing at ThinkNow.
What happens? What happens with the fake news stuff? I guess California, for example, just outlawed deep fakes, all that other good stuff. It seems like it's going to be a pretty big deal.
It's clearly going to be a big deal, especially as we go into another election cycle. The thing about deepfakes, as terrifying as it is and as real as it is, because I've seen some pretty convincing stuff, I whenever I'm asked this, I sometimes wonder, or I say, I don't know if it matters. Because I think we've learned over the last 2 years that people don't need evidence to believe something that they're told, right? So people will sit down in front of their favorite television show or their favorite publication or their favorite social media site, whatever it is, and they're not going to go and verify whether it's real or not. So I don't think that it really matters. So you don't even necessarily need to create deepfakes as evidence.
So you think people are just going to... People are just fine with accepting, if they hear garbage information, they're just fine with like hanging on to that garbage information no matter what, to a degree.
I think once they hear it enough, they assume that it's been corroborated. It's almost like social media creates this synthetic blockchain of information, if you will. You know what I mean? Where I heard that this politician said this, or this celebrity did this or said this. And if it gets shared enough, has enough likes or has enough shares, or you've seen that pattern enough times, to you, it becomes true.
That's interesting. That's actually a really interesting point, because what you're basically saying is that it's almost like a neuron that fires at a certain point. You hear something happen and it's kind of like, oh, that's ridiculous. That would never happen. Then you see it twice, and you see it three times, and you see it four times, and then all of a sudden, like, the whole thing fires, and it basically says, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense, that's exactly the situation that we're in right now.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I'm going to get this attribution wrong. I think it was Douglas Rushkoff in the 90s who talked a lot about the fact that reality is a collective illusion, where, you know, if, you know, you see something crazy happening up in the sky, you look to people around you and be like, you guys see that? And as long as the other people say yes, then it exists. And, you know, what we're seeing in not just social media, but in the proliferation of news sources and that kind of stuff, is if it exists and enough people and enough other people see the same thing and you've heard it from other people, then you assume it exists. So I think that, you know, deep fakes is, you know, it's a thing. It's interesting. Like, you can make someone do or say something that's, you know, that looks real, but it didn't actually happen. It's a simulacra. But I don't think that, you know, I think pointing our fingers at that one thing as the source of our future problems with misinformation, I think is, in my opinion, somewhat misguided. I think it's happening without it.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like that sounds fair as well. I mean, basically, we can't blame everything on deepfakes, but we should blame a lot on deepfakes, I guess. I'm not sure.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, it's symptomatic of what's happening, and I think, you know, that's why, you know, I think more, and it, I have a, and I caveat this by saying my understanding of blockchain is nowhere near yours or probably most of the world, but this is why I think, you know, blockchain has a role in I guess media and journalism, because if, you know, if it can prove that a deep fake or a copy or false information is in fact false, if it's in the blockchain, we would see where that information has changed.
Yeah, I mean, it would be, I think that's one of my peccadilloes that I've been thinking about recently. It's kind of be like almost like a 3D verification, where you have three cameras that verify a scene has happened, or three pieces of information that verify something has happened, right? So like, you basically, if one camera is incorrect, then the other two are going to basically just fire off and say, hey, something's wrong here. This has been altered, that kind of thing. But that requires an entirely new vision of verification, need for verification. I mean, did we need verified information from Sony when we were thinking about posting a leaked phone or whatever? Do we need like 100%? But now we're basically in a situation where it's, I don't know, Emma Watson naked, and how do we confirm that or deny that that's actually her, that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's really no answer to that, and it becomes even more complex when you begin, and not to go too far off, you know, the deep end here, but that's when you start getting into, you know, synthetic data, which is very big now in artificial intelligence, and I think that is an incredibly interesting and useful technology when you're talking about, you know, machine learning and accelerating machine learning and artificial intelligence. I think it's really cool, but it also implies that there's you know, creation bias in the synthetic environments that you're creating in order to teach machines whether or not something is real in the first place.
Anyway, what are you guys working on over at ThinkDumb to fix the world?
Well, I don't know if this fixes the world, but we just got out of earnings season, which is for me is exciting, because I often find that stuff not boring, but not terribly exciting. But so we did a lot of stuff, you know, based on different companies, you know, hiring trends and their workforce size and comparing it to their stock performance and looking at, you know, where retail, you know, companies were opening and closing locations, and people are freaking out about the so-called retail apocalypse and all that kind of stuff. So we just got out of that. So that was interesting and fun. I'm working on something I'm super excited about right now, which is about how banks are behaving now in terms of mortgage lending compared to how they were behaving before 2008, and how they've sort of readjusted or not their lending, you know, their lending practices, and looking at, I've got millions of, basically what I'm looking at is millions of mortgages over the last 5 years, and I've got information on the lendees, you know, race and gender and location and all that kind of stuff, and looking at how lending has or has not changed since the 2008 meltdown, and how these banks have responded or not responded to the new laws that have been handed to them.
And that's fascinating, and I don't think anybody in outside of a organization like yours would be able to start digging into that, right?
I don't think so. It's because it's there's a lot of number crunching that goes into it. You know, I'm lucky enough to have a room full of nerds who are capable of doing this stuff, because Lord knows I wouldn't be able to do it myself. But you know, they were able to, you know, throw it into our magic machine and come back to me with what looks like really simple data where you see the change in the rate spread over the last, you know, 10 years. So yeah, I don't know. I think people are trying to do it. But I think that a lot of people are coming at it from a journalism angle, and not that that's a bad thing, but it means that they don't necessarily have the resources to crunch the numbers.
Okay, so all journalistic organizations should be bought by analytics firms, and then that's the answer.
I don't know. I mean, in my case, I certainly don't know. I know in my case, I was lucky enough to convince a couple of data analytics nerds from Princeton into starting a media arm, and they were probably crazy for agreeing to do it, but somehow it's worked out.
Josh, thanks for joining us on Techtopia. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, man.
Techtopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.